Omaha Public Radio presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club on Noon Forum. On today's program, we'll hear a talk by Daniel DeBenke, newly appointed Chief Executive Officer of Nebraska Medicine. He previously served as CEO of Medical College Physicians, Senior Associate Dean of Clinical Affairs Adult Practice, and Professor of Emergency Medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. With Congress preparing to repeal and replace the so-called Affordable Health Care Act, Dr. DeBenke will speak on the topic, The Future of Healthcare Beyond Obamacare, Disruptive Innovation. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, February 16, 2017, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Marcia Cady, a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
We're talking about healthcare. Healthcare is the talk these days in the halls of Congress, among healthcare providers, insurance executives, and around the kitchen table. Will and when will Congress repeal the Affordable Care Act? Will they have a replacement? What is the future of healthcare itself? Today, Dr. Daniel DeBenke, the Chief Executive Officer of Nebraska Medicine, the hospital and clinical partner of the University of Nebraska, the Medical Center, is here to give you his views on the current healthcare environment, the innovations ahead, and the direction Nebraska Medicine is taking. Dr. DeBenke became Nebraska Medicine's CEO last year. He was previously the CEO of the Medical College Physicians and Senior Associate Dean of Clinical Affairs Adult Practice and Professor of Emergency Medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. After Dr. DeBenke's presentation, we will open it up to questions from our audience. There is a pencil and paper on your table. Please write down any questions, and they will be brought up to me, and we will get them answered. Now, Dr. DeBenke.
Thanks, Marcia. I appreciate it. And those of you who've seen me speak before, I know a few of you have, know that I wander, so that I am now on a leash that is connected to me, but I want to be able to make some eye contact. And this is really an open forum for discussion. This is my first winter in Omaha, and so if this is the way every winter is in Omaha, then I think I made the right choice. I came from Milwaukee, so you can imagine. So this is nothing except for the ice. If you guys expected a discussion of what's going to happen with repeal, what's going to happen with replace, what's going to happen with Medicaid, I'll answer all of those with I don't know. And then we can done and we can continue with dinner. But what I want to make a point, and I think what I'm going to be presenting to you today is my thought. So it's my opinion, and you can agree with it or disagree with it. And I'm a big boy, and I can take criticism or discussion on that. But I think we're focusing on the wrong things. I think we're distracted by what's happening in Washington. I think that will play its course out. I think we've got some bigger issues from a healthcare standpoint that we need to pay attention to as healthcare providers. And when I say we, I mean healthcare providers that I think are much more important and are going to be much more disruptive moving forward. And so that's what I'm going to talk about. I'm happy to give you, if we have time at the end, some thoughts on my opinion on some of the issues around repeal and replace. And I'll tie some of that in. But I mean, things are changing. Things are changing every single day. We're distracted by Flynn. We're distracted by Russia. We're distracted by changes in nominees. We're distracted by what Price is going to do from an HHS standpoint. We're distracted by all of those sort of things. And it's going to work itself out, but there are some other issues. So I'm going to talk a bit about disruptive innovation and talk about how that impacts on healthcare. And when you talk about disruptive innovation, and I'll show you some examples from some other sectors, it's really when an innovation enters into a market or a sector and moves it in a new direction. It is like what I would call market evolution or sector evolution. It usually improves the market or the value network in ways that weren't expected when that disruptor enters the market. Sometimes it involves an innovative technology, but it doesn't have to. Usually technology is an enabler in moving along a disruption. It's often driven by a crisis in the market. And usually the market dominators are either oblivious to it, ignore it, or are distracted by a different distraction or a different crisis. I think that's what's happening in healthcare. I think there are innovations happening around us in healthcare that we're either not paying attention to, we're minimizing because we think they're not going to work, and we're distracted by what's going on in Washington. So I'm hoping to convince you the same. So I'll give you a couple of examples from some other markets of disruptive innovation. So obviously, Amazon entered the market really as a book and music seller from online standpoint, and even some other components of other buying powers, and really disrupted the market around book selling, music selling, CD selling, those sort of things. So one example of market disruption. So Blockbuster. Who even knows that there's a Blockbuster around anymore? Blockbuster, really interesting story. Blockbuster was benchmarking themselves against other bricks and mortar companies and saying, we're doing really well. Look how we compare against Redbox. Look how we compare against grocery stores. While at the bottom of the market, technology-enabled streaming video came into the market and completely disrupted that. And so they weren't really paying attention to the right components of the market. Another great example, digital photography. Another good story. Kodak actually had the rights initially to digital photography from a patent standpoint, and they passed it up. They said that's a fad. It's not going to take off. And so I don't know how many of you still use 35-millimeter film and load that into your camera. Probably everybody uses their phone now. And another disruptor, obviously, digital music, the iPod. And really making obsolete CDs, cassette tapes, et cetera. Again, very interesting approach to the market, completely disregarded by CD and other music makers. And obviously there are significant components during that disruption related to copyright and those sort of things. But those are the type of things that really do disrupt a market. And we've seen some in recent years. I never call a cab anymore when I'm traveling. I've got an Uber app. I've got my credit cards loaded in. I'm sure many of you do the same thing, and I request an Uber, and I don't think I've been in a yellow cab in a couple of years. And final example is what's happening in the hospitality and hoteling market with Airbnb. And really disrupting your classic hotel chain operations. Now, just because disruptors enter the market doesn't mean that market dominators can't react, but they have to be nimble, they have to be thoughtful, and they have to learn, I think, a different skill set, which may not be related to market domination, but may be related to innovative partnership. So what's healthcare's crisis? What is it that's distracting us? What is it that is causing disruption in the market? Look at where the United States is. We spend more on healthcare than any of the other EU 15 countries, and we have not such great life expectancy. So there's a lot of argument that, well, healthcare in the United States is so expensive, but look at all the great care that we give. That doesn't play itself out in the data. And so this is the crisis that's driving a lot of the changes that you're going to see from a disruption standpoint. This is unsustainable. And so that unsustainability, the fact that we spend 16% of our GDP on healthcare and don't have the greatest life expectancy, drove the ACA. 2010, the ACA was put into act. Regardless of what you think from a partisan standpoint, from a personal standpoint, about the ACA, and it has significant flaws related to it. It has things that need and will be tweaked regardless of what happens. It achieved its goal. More people are covered under some sort of insurance product. And really, we've been at a pretty significant plateau since the last major social reform, which was Medicare and Medicaid, at about 15-ish percent uninsured. And after the ACA, that has dropped down to 9%. So we have more individuals covered, regardless of what you think about how that happened or what the mechanisms were to pay for that or any of those other issues. That has been achieved by the ACA. I know a sensitive issue in this state is Medicaid expansion. And I came from a non-Medicaid expansion state, so I understand the politics related to it, regardless of your thoughts about the politics, about federal support to a state level, state control, all of those issues. In those states that had Medicaid expansion, there was more coverage for the population. There was improvement in coverage in non-Medicaid expansion states as well, but not to the degree that was seen in Medicaid expansion states. And for the first time since about 2010, what we've seen actually is in the government-based payment mechanisms, there's actually been a decrease in spending. There's not been an annual increase. We've seen that in the private insurance sector as well, the decline, but it's not gone to the point where there's not been an annual growth in spending. So here we are. But my point that I want to make is, have we been distracted by this show that's happened? And have we been distracted while a true healthcare marketplace has developed around us, a real marketplace of consumerism where individuals choose their healthcare based on a variety of different inputs? Have we missed that? Have we not been paying attention to that? And should we be paying attention to that? Because that's going to drive many of the changes that we think, I think, from a healthcare delivery standpoint, are absolutely essential for quality healthcare. So I think, again, this is my DeBinke's view, and we can have a dialogue about that. I think it's going to be an intersection of about four disruptors. There's going to be some consumerism and data transparency, and I'll walk through each of these and give you my thoughts about what I think that might look like. There will be enablers from a technology standpoint that will enable those disruptors, and there's an ongoing retail revolution that we absolutely have to pay attention to. So, consumerism. There has really never been a healthcare, true healthcare market. When I say a market, I mean individuals look at price and at product quality and make an informed decision based upon that. That's just not been the history of United States healthcare up until now. But we're at that point now. And we're at that point because of some components of the ACA. If you look at employer coverage, how employers cover anybody in here a small business owner? How employers actually cover their employees. They've got a couple of choices now under the ACA, and really even regardless of the ACA. You can abdicate coverage. In other words, you just get out of the coverage business. You're not going to provide health care coverage for your employees. You obviously completely lose that escalated rising premium component of an expense for your organization. You do run the risk, obviously, of mandate penalties and also of alienating the labor market. And in a tight labor market, such as we're in here, that's probably not a smart move. You can shift to private exchanges, and that's what we've seen since the beginning of the ACA, is this movement to defined contribution from an employer health plan standpoint. So I give you $5,000, and I say, good luck. Please go find your health care. I'm going to give you $5,000 each year, and then you go on the exchanges and you shop. So it does have some responsiveness to employee choice because you get to choose what your health care looks like. You get a defined contribution, and your employer knows what that contribution is per employee, so you understand your expenses. It does disrupt benefit design a bit because each individual employee is going out to the marketplace and choosing what's available there for their health care. And it risks, and we saw this with the exchanges, under insurance. The whole idea behind a large doing things like covering existing conditions and those sort of things is you need a broad risk pool. And so you need healthy young individuals to purchase insurance. And if any of you know, I'm a parent of a 26 and a 27 year old who have to now shop on the exchanges. They're not informed consumers when it comes to healthcare, and they may choose not to choose anything. And that's what we saw from the exchanges. Or you can actually take it into your own hands and convert to self-funding. you can actually take control of that as an employer. You control the network design, so you decide who's in and who's out of your network, who your employees are going to be able to go to based upon the defined contribution that you give them. You get exempted from the minimum benefit requirements that are seen. There is some greater financial risk, and that risk has been pushed a bit and shared with the employees now from a deductible standpoint. And you have to assemble a network. So you have to decide what providers, physicians, health delivery networks, et cetera, are in your network. So as employers begin to define their networks and narrow that down, if you as an employee go out of network, you're out of pocket, your deductible goes up pretty significantly. So there is this pressure to stay in network that has been chosen by your employer. And just giving you an idea of this narrowing of the networks, but basically almost 70% are either in an ultra-narrow or a very narrow type of network. In other words, individual providers and health systems have been excluded. Basically, they've said, our patients can no longer come to you. Our employees can no longer come to you. And I know that that was witnessed in this market, not from an exchange standpoint, but with one of the major third-party payers in the market. But by narrowing of that network and then making the obligation at the employee level for their out-of-pocket much higher for out-of-network providers, really employers are taking control and shifting some of that cost obligation to the patient, to the employee. And this is astounding to me. 39% on the exchanges had a deductible of $6,000 or more, individual deductible. Now, I do think that that's ridiculous, but it's a reality. And I'll show you, it's what's driving the consumerism that we're seeing in the healthcare market from a disruption standpoint. You have nearly 70% on the exchanges that have a deductible greater than $3,000. I know my 26 and 27-year-old can't afford $3,000. Or they'll call me. So it's driving shopability. It's driving this out of this shift of financial obligation to the patient, to the consumer. The actual consumer is making them do exactly what a market does. It makes them shop for those shoppable things that they can go out and look at pricing and make a decision on. If you're going to get heart surgery, a hip replacement, heart failure admission, you're going to blow past any deductible that you have. You're not going to shop for that. And frankly, that's not a chooser type of market. Where you get your screening colonoscopy after you're 50 years old, where you get your mammogram, where you get your total knee done electively, where you get those things, those are shoppable. And people will do exactly that. They will go and they will look and shop for those things. So our obligation as healthcare delivery providers is to provide that value to our patients, because the patients are looking for that now because of that shift of financial obligation to them. Which brings in this data transparency. This is what I'm talking about. This is the disruptors. I don't know if any of you have seen this before, but Smart Choice MRI. If you're choosing and you've got a $3,000 a year deductible, where are you going to get your knee MRI? Not where you're going to get your pancreas cancer MRI. That's a different decision. But those shoppables where you're going to get your knee MRI, where you're going to get your back MRI if your doctor wants you to get that, where are you going to go? If you've got $3,000 that you have to pay out of your pocket, I can't, and I know my friends at Methodist can't compete with a $600 MRI with our fixed costs within our institutions. We can't. And we probably shouldn't. We probably shouldn't. We should learn to partner. Cleveland Clinic has partnered with Smart Choice MRI, and they're providing the professional services for that. But this is what consumers are looking for. And it's this data transparency, the ability to shop by price in those services that are shoppable by price, that are commodity-based, which is driving a lot of decision-making by consumers. And so enter some technology enablers that allow patients to actually search by price. Castlight is one. The Healthcare Blue Book is another. Many of these are actually being pushed by employers to their employees to say, you know, you've got a $3,000 deductible. if you need, please use this app when you're searching for where you're going to get your colonoscopy or where you're going to get your knee arthroscopy. And these services search the databases, get appropriate pricing, and allow you, just as if you're searching for a big screen TV or anything else, you can look and see and try to understand what the pricing looks like for those services. And not only is that happening, but this is what's really changing the game is related to picking your provider. I mean, we often assume quality. We assume that providers provide the same degree of quality. That's probably not the case, but there's never been any real good data for consumers to look at to say, how do I choose my doctor? You know, I can more easily decide what TV I'm going to buy in an hour online by looking at pricing, comparing to big box stores, looking at Yelp reviews and all that, and deciding which I pick. And healthcare is going to get to that. There's health grades. There's many other services. Actually, at Nebraska Medicine, what we'll be doing and be rolling out in the end of this year, so end of our fiscal year in June, early July, is every single one of our physicians will have an online ranking. It'll be on a star rating based upon actual ratings of that provider by their patients, and there will be all the comments related to that provider that the patients were able to give, completely transparent externally. And so you can go online and actually look at the provider and see how many stars out of five they have, what the patients have said about them. And so that's that degree of data transparency that's really important in making those consumer decisions. And then you add a bit of technology. So many of these, what I would call virtual urgent cares, are cropping up, run remotely out of other organizations or partnered with healthcare delivery networks like ours and others, where you can go online 24/7 and access a provider. And not have to go to a bricks and mortar facility at 2 in the morning when your child has a fever and a painful ear. You can talk to a provider, you can get a prescription, you can get all those things done. This ties into some of the things I'm going to talk about with respect to the retail revolution, but we're seeing some crop-ups of these kiosks in department stores, in some pharmacies where you can go in, you can talk to a physician, you can receive advice, you can get some screening done, et cetera. MD Live on your own computer, you can talk to a physician in a particular specialty related to the particular problems that you may have. And I can book a table on OpenTable for tonight like that. And we should be able to do that in healthcare. You should be able to go online on an app on your phone and say, I'd like to see a primary care physician tomorrow at 2 o'clock, and you should be able to look and see and find that. And that is going to turn, and some have done that, and we're at Nebraska Medicine, we're beginning to look at how we do online appointments for our established and for new patients. Where I came from in Milwaukee, we had rolled it out. It's a culture change for physicians. It is. I'm speaking as a physician. I may wear a suit, but I'm still a doctor at heart. And it scares a lot of physicians who have had significant control over their schedules in the past. To open that up and to be like an open table is a little bit frightening, but it is absolutely what we have to do. And those that adopt that technology and that approach, that disruption, are going to be the ones that come out on top. And then finally, the retail revolution. And, you know, I talked a bit about disruption, and oftentimes we don't see it coming, or it comes from a place that you just never expected it to come from. Walmart has gone public by saying they want to be the largest primary care provider in the United States. Walmart. And they've started down that road. Some Walmarts now have a clinic inside the Walmart. And it's just it's a fascinating business model as well, and I'll talk a little bit about that. So it's a $4 or a $40 approach. $4 for employees. you can get your primary care. You can get your immunization, your flu shot, your diabetes screening, a blood pressure check, cold, anything that you've got as an employee you can get for $4. So that's a benefit for Walmart employees. What's most fascinating is the $40 primary care appointment for non-employees. So you can go in and pay $40 and get that same primary care approach that the employees get. I can't, and I don't know any primary care provider that has bricks and mortar, clinics, those sort of things, can cover a primary care cost for $40. $140 maybe, but not $40. And it's, you know, I would suggest to you that Walmart's not doing this because of an altruistic approach to primary care. It is a business model, right? So Walmart has what they call the Walmart scale as they profile consumers. I don't know if you've ever heard of this. They profile Walmart shoppers from a 1 to a 10, with 1 being somebody who occasionally comes into the store, maybe buys something, to 10 to being the Walmart warriors who are there every single day and buy everything at Walmart. And so by trying to bring people in and pulling it, doing it using a pull technique of a primary care provider, they've estimated that if they can move somebody on the Walmart scale from a 5 to a 6, that's $100 billion to their bottom line. Because you're there and then you decide you buy diapers and you're going to buy something else. And so it's a retail strategy. It's a strategy to get you there to buy things. And they're doing it with a healthcare pull. And it is really difficult as a primary care provider or an organization that provides primary care to compete with that. Now, so what does that mean? Do we ignore it? Do I say, it'll be a fad? It'll go away? No, we need to partner around those things. So if we really want to control a population, if we want to be sure that we're actually controlling cost, these sort of things fragment healthcare, right? So if you go to Walmart and get your primary care visit and get your immunization, what medical record do they use? How do they know? How do I know when you come to my facility what care you received at Walmart? So our job, really, if we're truly thinking about down the road controlling the health of a population, I've got to somehow connect with Walmart or any of those other retail disruptors to be able to understand when patients that are attributed to me, that I'm in charge of, either from a financing standpoint or whatever, have actually accessed healthcare outside of my institution so that I can bridge that continuum of care. Can't ignore that stuff. You see it with CVS as well. Many of the pharmacies are doing this with these minute clinics and bringing in usually advanced practice providers, so NPs or PAs that provide the care. Interesting, the minute clinic and the CVS have partnered with Epic, which is a major healthcare EMR, electronic medical record provider, and their electronic medical record in the pharmacies and the minute clinics is actually Epic. And Epic has about 50 to 55% market share across the United States. So it's just another opportunity to connect that. And many of the major health systems also have Epic as their health electronic health record. So the ability to connect to that and to be able to see when your patients are being cared for within one of those fragmented delivery areas is important. And so the provocative question that I'll leave you with, and then we'll have lots of time to just have a general dialogue and a discussion, is traditional healthcare as we know it, as delivered by the bricks and mortar that you see at 42nd and Dewey or 84th and Dodge, is that becoming obsolete? Is that the new Alamo? Are we kind of making our last stand? And while we're engaging in all of this partisan rhetoric, and what's going to happen in Congress, and you know, what did Flynn know, and when did he know it, and all of that sort of stuff, when we're paying attention to that, the disruptors are forming the market around us. And if we don't pay attention to that as a delivery network, if we don't change our mindset about how we provide care in a patient-centric way that provides value to the consumer, not value to the doctor, not value to the health system, but value to the consumer, we're going to miss the boat, completely miss the boat. And so I'll say, you know, while we're focusing on the existing bridge, which we know is traditional healthcare, this existing bridge, and how do we make it stronger, and how do we make sure that it gets from point A from point B, what's happening is the river's moving. We're focusing on the bridge, and the river's moving. And so we got to figure out where the river's going and start to think about how to build the bridge over that new river. So that is my thing. And so I am happy now to answer any questions, have you throw things at me, tell me I'm completely wrong, ask for clarifications, those sort of things. And you've got some excellent.
I have a question here for you. What is the main thing that needs to be done in controlling health care costs?
Geez, that's the one question. What's the main thing that needs to be done to control healthcare costs? It's actually, I would say, and I'll think about, I'll spin it just a little bit. The question, that's my prerogative, right? So I'll change the question a little bit. I think we need to focus on the healthcare delivery network on unnecessary waste, unnecessary utilization. There are many things that we do that we either do very inefficiently from a personnel or from a facility standpoint, or don't need to be done at all. MRIs for back pain, CT scans for minor head injuries, many of those sort of things. So I think if you, it may not be the single thing, but it's probably the most important and probably the easiest thing for us to do without disrupting our current business models, is actually to focus on unnecessary utilization and waste within the delivery network.
As a physician and a CEO, how do you deal with physician resistance, disruption, telemedicine, the consumer rankings, et cetera?
That's a great question. So prior to coming here, I was a CEO of a large academic physician practice, 1,500 academic physicians. And so some have likened that to herding cats. I actually like it to herding squirrels because cats are actually domesticated. And actually, cats will follow where you put the food. So it is a bit, I think that there actually is a desire from a physician standpoint to do what's right for our patients. We just got to be shown how to do it. And we need to feel as though, and I'm saying we now, we as a physician, we have to feel as though we have a say and a point in making those decisions. I instituted back in Milwaukee the online physician ratings, and doing so now within Nebraska Medicine. And I thought for sure I was going to need to look under my car for a bomb and those sort of things. And it was complete. There was no pushback. Everybody said, because this is online reputation management, right? It's going to be there anyway. People are going to rate you, and they're going to rate you on Yelp and health grades. Why not do it on based upon a large number of reports? So I think probably the most important thing I've learned from being a physician and from leading physicians is they want to have a say. They want to they don't want somebody in a suit, even if it's a doc in a suit, telling them what to do. They need to be told why and have some data to show that it's the right direction to go. But at the end of the day, we all want to do the right thing, which is take really good care of our patients.
Is a mandate essential to getting more people to be insured, or can that be accomplished in some other way?
Yeah. Wow, that's a great question. You guys are trying to bait me on the political side, aren't you? I'm going to stay away from the word mandate. The idea is, if we want the things that have already been put in place, coverage for pre-existing conditions, coverage of your children till the age of 26, you have to broaden the pool, the risk pool, the individuals that are actually in whatever that is. How you do that, whether that's a mandate that you have to have coverage or some other mechanism, you have to have either risk corridors, or you have to have individuals who have almost no or minimal spend, who are healthy young individuals in the risk pool. That's been the failure up to this point, and why the pricing on the exchanges has been so volatile is because that didn't happen. So if we want to continue those coverage components, the individuals that are going to utilize healthcare, chronic conditions, pre-existing conditions, we have to broaden the base. And I don't pretend to be smart enough or political enough to know how best to do that, how to fund that. But that's what has to happen. And some, you know, the ACA viewed it as a mandate, and that was what was put in place. Whether that's the right answer or not, I don't know. But you have to have that broad base.
In achieving the goals of getting more people covered and a lower cost for health care in the system, are you optimistic or pessimistic for the long term?
Oh, boy. I'm optimistic because I think at the end of the day, people are going to do the right thing. And I think there are people in Washington who are smart and who can reach across the political aisle and make the right decisions. It's not going to happen quickly, and it's not going to happen overnight. And regardless of what happened from a from an election standpoint, wherever you stand from your partisan leaning, there needed to be changes made to the ACA. The ACA was not perfect, and we needed a little run rate to see where we are and then to make some changes in that. So whether it was a Democratic win or a Republican win, there needed to be changes. Now, campaigning is very different than governing. And so, and I think that our leaders now in Washington are understanding is that, you know, campaign promises and what people campaigned on are sometimes very difficult to deliver from a governing standpoint. You got to be careful in how you implement that. And so that's going to be, I think that's going to be the real issue. I think there's going to be changes. I think there'll be incremental changes. I think there are some components that are going to need to stay. And I think our current president has viewed that those things are important, such as pre-existing conditions and those sort of things. So I'm optimistic we'll get in the right spot. What I've said to my leadership team and said to the organization is, listen, here's the deal. Focus on providing value to our patients. That means product quality, which is outcomes and experience, at an efficient price. That's the right equation, no matter what happens. If that's not the right equation, then I'm going to pack up shop and I'll, you know, make woodwork in my garage or something. If delivering value to our patients isn't the ultimate goal, then we're in the wrong business.
As an expert in the field, has anybody come to you for advice, namely like young House of Representatives, congressmen, asking you what is it that we should be talking about and doing in Washington?
Yeah, actually, it's good. And so this group knows many of my friends from Methodist and others. Congressman Bacon had us at a healthcare roundtable this last weekend to talk about exactly those. What are the things that he should be paying attention to? What are the issues at hand? This is complex. All of the components of this, and this is kind of what we took away from the healthcare roundtable, is that our leaders in Washington and at the state level are just coming up to speed on all of this. We could stay here all day and talk about components of the ACA, the intricacies of that, MACRA, MIPS, the CMMI, all of these things that are, you know, that we all know really as healthcare experts in delivery networks. We know intimately because we're dealing with it. Our legislators are just scraping the surface of understanding this. And so it's our job to educate. And so we did that with Congressman Bacon this weekend, and I'm sure that all of my colleagues recommend the opportunity to do that whenever they can.
How can you share records partnering with Walmart or CVS and comply with HIPAA?
If it's in the electronic health record, then it is controlled. It's a HIPAA compliant. And so with data sharing agreements, you can do those sort of things. So it is, I can, you know, if you see another provider, let's say you go to a provider here in town who's on Epic, I at Nebraska Medicine, my providers will have access to that because it's in continuity of caring for you as a patient.
The most expensive care is end-of-life care. Should we be approaching such care in a different way?
Absolutely. That's a great question. That's a great point. Probably the most significant spend for a Medicare beneficiary, and this is the data that I know, for a Medicare beneficiary are in the last few weeks of life. And so we need to, and this got twisted the wrong way, I think, under early Clinton health plan reform. You know, we heard about the death committees and those sort of things. It is not about that. It is about providing compassionate healthcare at the end of life. And we can do that in a cost-conscious way that improves the overall value to the patient. But it's easy. And as a provider, I mean, I'll tell you this. It's easy to do the next thing because we know how to do that. It's much more difficult as a provider to have that end-of-life conversation and to say, I think that we should do less as opposed to we should do more. We were talking, and my colleague Cliff Robertson from CHI, there's a wonderful book, and I think it's called How Doctors Die Differently, and it is about the dichotomy between how doctors choose end-of-life care and how they recommend end-of-life care to their patients because they know. And it's very interesting. It is absolutely an important thing. There's a great study looking at patients with lung cancer. And they did a controlled trial where they took half of the patients and they did conventional care for them with lung cancer. And they took half of the patients early on the diagnosis of lung cancer, and put them in a group that received palliative care. And the ones in the palliative care group lived longer and had a better meaningful life to that point in the measurement. So you'd think putting people in palliative care, they live longer? That doesn't make any sense. It certainly does, because you provide resources and social services and support, psychological, spiritual support around the patient, and their perceived how they felt about their health care and about their life was better, and they lived longer.
Drug pricing is in the news. It seems to be one indicator of the increase in health care costs. What can be done to curb health drug pricing?
Yeah, I don't know what the answer to that is. There are some provisions, I think, in some of the proposed plans by some that can do that, that will deal with pricing. You're right. It is actually a really big deal. There are some programs, actually one of them called a 340B pricing program, that provides lower cost to institutions based upon their population of patients that they provide care to that have a lower socioeconomic status. And that that has been on the chopping block at least for a while. That would be devastating if that happened, because that's really driving affordable pricing so that we can pass on medications to our patients at an affordable price. I don't know what the right answer is to that.
We've seen a cropping up of physician-centered practices, the think whole person concept, for example. What do you think of that concept of bringing a provider in and having them control all of what the patient needs?
I mean, that is the model of providing value, whether it's the think model or what the patient-centered medical home model, where we wrap social services and other services around the patient, behavioral health and others, really caring for that with the primary care provider being the quarterback of care. Who best to know you than your primary care provider, the one that has been with you or provides and orchestrates all of your care. So anything that is a patient-centric, value-driven model to the patient is the right answer. And that we should have the ability to experiment with some of those. I don't know what the right model is, but there are opportunities to experiment with those. One of the things that the ACA has stood up is called the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, or known as the CMMI. And that's where things like ACOs and bundled payments and episodic payments, these experiments that health delivery networks can partake in and understand what's the best model for caring for our patients and providing value, that's a great opportunity. The concern is with the repeal of ACA is that on the chopping block as well. And that would be unfortunate, because that has really driven some real opportunities. It's driven the ACO, Accountable Care Organization model, which we're partnered with our Methodist colleagues in providing value-based care to our patients. It's driven many of the bundled payments, the total joint bundle, and other things, which are really good experiments in how to provide value to our patients. High quality, efficient cost.
What happens to the brick and mortar that hospitals and clinics have when these kind of disruptors begin?
Well, that's a good question. I think we have to think about how we repurpose. I think we have to think about what other services can we co-locate in those areas to drive value out of the bricks and mortars that we have. And we have to be really careful about new bricks and mortar. We have to think about as we build new buildings, and I say that as I've got a $323 million building coming out of the ground. But we have to be really careful about that. I think one of the things, and I'll say this from an academic medical center standpoint, and we've had some strategists come in and are helping us with volume projections over the next 10 years and asking exactly those questions. Where should we put a next clinic? Should we have a new bed tower? Those sort of things. And if you look nationally at what's inpatient utilization, so that's people in beds in hospitals, the national trend is decreasing, so about 3% or so. So there's supposed to be less people in beds. That's not what we're feeling from an academic medical center standpoint. What we're seeing from an academic medical center is we've got more sick people in beds. And so we've got to figure out if we're adding beds, how many do we need to add, and are they equipped for the type of population that we're going to see in the future? So many of the services that we previously and currently provide in a inpatient facility, heart and vascular services and others, are going to move to an outpatient environment. So hopefully some of our outpatient bricks and mortar we can repurpose for those sort of things and repurpose the beds on the inpatient side for the sicker population that we're ultimately going to see.
What kind of incentives are needed to get young people to become primary care deliverers instead of specialists in medicine?
Yeah, I think one is recognizing that actually their importance to the delivery network and what it means to be a primary care provider. The other incentives is that we need to have appropriate tools in their hands so that it's not just extra work to manage a population, that there's the appropriate support services and staff around them, social services, behavioral health. That draws people in to primary care. The other thing is the debt burden coming out of medical school now is amazing. I mean, I saw some numbers. I can't remember what it was. It's nearly $100,000 to $150,000 that a medical student has when they come out of medical school of debt to pay back. And so when you look at the salary of a primary care provider and the salary of a orthopedic surgeon and the fact that you've got a $150,000 bogey sitting there that you got to take care of over multiple years, I can see how the decision making goes. So we have to provide, I would say, relief or relief to that debt burden for those individuals that actually choose primary care as their specialty, if we believe, and I do, that primary care is what we need to be investing in.
How do you bring health care to the rural areas of Nebraska?
It's a great question. I think that's where the technology component comes in. I think there's real opportunity to leverage what I would call telepresence or telemedicine, the ability to remotely provide healthcare to rural environments through specialists, through primary care, through diabetes counselors, through those type of venues, so that you get that care and can manage those populations, but that local community doesn't have to invest in the providers to actually provide that care. We've got a telestroke service that we've rolled out across the state that has been doing wonderfully, whereby in a rural community, if a patient appears in an emergency department at a critical access hospital or other access point, the technology that we have there is able to connect that provider and the patient to our stroke specialist so that we're able to provide consultative care and then determine where best for that patient to go. You can do that in primary care. You can do that in diabetes. You can do that in all the specialties. And so I think leveraging that technology is important. This is an interesting state to me, and so I'm getting used to it. I didn't realize that Scotts Bluff is 7.5 hours away, yet we have a campus there. And I can actually drive to Milwaukee faster than I can drive to Scotts Bluff, yet they're really important for the care of the patients across the state, North Platte, all of those. So connecting with them in a technology-enabled way, I think, is the answer. It's not about adding more bricks and mortar. It's certainly not about us adding more providers. That's too expensive and just not the right answer. If we can leverage existing resources from a provider standpoint using technology, that's the right answer in a state like of this size.
What advice would you give to the regular Joe out there about what they should start learning about healthcare so they can be a better consumer?
Well, it's about the quality of your provider and the cost of the services. I mean, it's really about choosing wisely. And I think we're getting better at getting that quality data out there. It's probably not perfect, but it's really important to do that. I think also it's the whole package. It's about the experience. So you can have a really high-quality provider that's economically in a good spot, is fiscally responsible, so the cost is not prohibited. And if you can't get in for 6 weeks, that's a problem, right? So access is a big deal. So I think those are the things that a chooser should look for. They should look for what's the experience of being seen by that provider, meaning their access, how they're rated, do they have a good bedside manner, what are their quality outcomes related to the type of care that they provide, and then from a cost standpoint, is the cost fiscally responsible?
If healthcare CEOs could write a healthcare law, what would it look like?
Jeez, that's a beat. Well, writing the law is not the hard part. Funding the law is the hard part. So I'm not going to talk about the funding part because I don't pretend to be smart enough about how best to do that. But the law should have some of the things that we've seen that I think are really important from a social standpoint: the ability to cover pre-existing conditions, the ability to cover individuals in your family up to a particular age. So I think that those should stay in. I think a broader base of coverage, so more individuals are covered with appropriate minimum coverage requirements. So, you know, you could have minimum coverage that doesn't really get you anything, and you could be called covered under a particular plan, yet really you're not getting any health care. It's got to be the appropriate coverage across the population and as broad as possible. I don't know. I mean, that's the way that I would write it. I don't know how to fund that without having some sort of government involvement in the funding. And I know that that's the biggest concern, but you can't fund it off the back of the patient. That's just not going to happen. It's unless we have some sort of draconian approach to our pricing or our costs. So there's got to be some balance there. I'm just not sure what the right answer is from funding.
Could you explain the interrelationship between Nebraska Medicine, the UNMC, Clarkson, Children's, et cetera?
Yes, I'll try. I'll try quickly. Nebraska Medicine is a new entity. It is legally now an actual 501c3, so a separate corporate entity. And that was true as of July 1st of this year. The parents of Nebraska Medicine is the University of Nebraska Board of Regents and Clarkson Regional Health Services. Clarkson Regional Health Services is really those individuals who had run the original Clarkson Hospital, and the Board of Regents ran the University Hospital, and in 97 those came together. So Nebraska Medicine has its own board. I'm the CEO of Nebraska Medicine. I report to that board, and then we have parents who have particular reserve rights related to the decisions that we make. They're very broad reserve rights around, you know, we can't dissolve the company, we can't take on significant debt, those sort of things. Underneath Nebraska Medicine, so underneath that new corporation, are really four entities, three and a half. Bellevue Hospital, University of Nebraska Medical Center Physicians, UNMCP, which was the physician practice of UNMC, which is now in Nebraska Medicine. UNMCP, Bellevue, the Nebraska Medical Center, so TNMC, the 42nd and Dewey campus, and 49% of the Nebraska Orthopedic Hospital. We have a joint venture with them. UNMC is the health sciences university that provides education and research and is the partner of Nebraska Medicine in delivery of healthcare. So healthcare doesn't happen at UNMC. It happens at Nebraska Medicine, but we're partnered with UNMC from an educational standpoint. Children's is a separate organization, a 501c3 separate nonprofit healthcare network. We have some relationships, contractual relationships with Children's, and we're working. Many of you may have seen in the news, we signed a memorandum of understanding of how we can work more closely together while remaining independent organizations, but provide better coordinated health care for the children in Nebraska and beyond. So that's the relationship between us and Children's Hospital and Children's Hospital and Medical Center. So it's I've only been here 6 months, and so it's an interesting relationship, but I think it's working well.
Well, to conclude, anything that we didn't ask or that you still want to tell us?
No, I mean, I think we can. Boy, we covered a lot, and you asked me some really, really good questions. I mean, I think. You asked the question before about optimism. I am optimistic. I think that that we've got really good healthcare delivery in this community, not just Nebraska Medicine, but our partners at Methodist, CHI, Children's, Boys Town. This is a good place to be. We've got great physicians and partners within the city, so and within the community, and within the state, and we're a resource. So this is a good place to be. There's some tweaking that needs to happen, and that's just the way healthcare is. But I wouldn't want to be anyplace else, to be honest with you.
Our thanks to our guests, to our audience here at the Press Club, and to KIOS Radio for recording our noon forum. We are adjourned.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club on Noon Forum. On today's program, we've heard a talk by Daniel DeBenke, newly appointed Chief Executive Officer of Nebraska Medicine. He previously served as CEO of Medical College Physicians, Senior Associate Dean of Clinical Affairs Adult Practice, and Professor of Emergency Medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. With Congress preparing to repeal and replace the so-called Affordable Health Care Act, Dr. DeBenke spoke on the topic, The Future of Healthcare Beyond Obamacare, Disruptive Innovation. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, February 16, 2017, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club holds these noontime educational forums each month. The next program will be this Thursday, March 16th at 12 noon. At that time, the special guest will be Omaha reenactor Daryl Draper, appearing in the persona of Peter Sarpy, for whom Sarpy County is named. To help celebrate the 150th anniversary of Nebraska statehood, he'll describe the transformation of Nebraska from French colony to statehood. If you'd like to attend this or other future programs in the series, call the Omaha Press Club at 402-345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.